I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Ask anyone who's ever served overseas and they'll tell you how much it means to get mail. And letters from soldiers are also eagerly anticipated. The writer, Andrew Carroll, has a new collection of letters called Behind the Lines. Everything from the personal to the poetic. For example, the British artist Paul Nash describing the fury of shellfire in the First World War.
They whine and plunge overhead, tearing away the rotting tree stumps, breaking the plank roads, striking down horses and mules. Annihilating, maiming, maddening, they plunge into the grave which is this land, one huge grave, and cast up the poor dead. Oh, it is unspeakable, godless, hopeless. I am no longer an artist interested and curious. I am a messenger who will bring back word from men fighting to those who want the war to last forever. Feeble, inarticulate will be my message, but it will have a bitter truth. And may it burn their lousy souls.
Carroll cast a wide net for this collection. These are not just letters from American boys on the front lines, but letters from among the Vietnamese and the Japanese and even Iraqis, along with letters to fathers and letters from mothers. We're talking about the power of wartime correspondence this hour. We'd like to hear your stories as well. What do letters tell us about war that we don't read in the newspapers and the history books? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Andrew Carroll is here. The name of his new book is Behind the Lines. It's nice to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
You spent a lot of time on the road for this book.
This was a much different book than the first one, War Letters, which was only American correspondence that people had sent to me in my home in Washington. I went to 35 countries around the world to track these letters down. And in this email age, I probably could have done this book from home and just emailed veterans groups and archives and museums and said, send me your best stuff. But I wanted to go and see these places. I wanted to see the beaches of Normandy, and I wanted to go to the demilitarized zone outside of Seoul. I wanted, if possible, to go to Iraq and Afghanistan, which I was able to do. And people were, when I left, everyone said, especially my well-traveled friends, you will have no luck with this. This is at the height of anti-American sentiment around the world.
Oh, that's right. I didn't even think about that.
And people were burning the American flag. There were protests. There were rallies. What happened was every city, every town, every country, people went out of their way to share letters and emails, whether it was in the former Soviet Union trying to get letters by Russians who had been at Stalingrad, or if it was in Korea getting letters from the Korean War. Everybody felt not just a willingness, but an urgency to share these letters. It was extraordinary.
Tell me why you thought you'd find something different by going beyond the shores of this country. I mean, this country has seen so much war.
What's amazing is the people who encouraged me to do this were American veterans. They were the ones who said, you need to expand this project. We had more than, I think, 50,000 American letters when this project really got going and when War Letters came out in 2001. And as I went around the country talking with active duty troops and with veterans, they said, you've got to expand this. This project is not about letters anymore. It's about war. And these are the most authentic voices we have on the subject of war, those who've been right there in the front lines, not just troops, but as you mentioned earlier, civilians. More civilians have died in the past 100 years than troops have. And so I wanted to get 9/11 letters, Holocaust letters. And in fact, one of the things that made me think of doing this book was during 9/11, we talked so much about the Londoners who had survived the Blitz and what they were going through during that time. And I thought how amazing it would be to show letters written by the British during World War II who were being bombed incessantly, and then show what people had written during 9/11. In fact, a woman gave me a 14-page handwritten letter that she wrote after she survived. She was at Ground Zero. And just the moment-by-moment account of being right there at that time. And it's very similar to things that have been written 50 to 100 years earlier.
There's stuff, though, that I would have thought that would be very provocative. A letter from a young Vietnamese, can't remember if it's a man or a woman, saying to a brother, go and kill these Americans. And yet in the context of all these other letters, it doesn't quite appear that same way.
No, and that surprised me too. And I was a little reluctant to include that letter. It was given to me by an American veteran. He had actually taken it off the body. Wow. Of the Vietnamese soldier. And so is that soldier's brother writing to him saying, and it was really, it's not as incendiary as it sounds. What he's saying is that we've just lost a big part of our family from a bombing, and I think any of us would be able to empathize with a sense of just the anger. So one of the things I wanted to show in the book is the emotions, the raw emotions that come out in wartime. Now, I'm sort of jumping ahead, and I want to come back to this later, but I think to me, the most powerful part of the book are the letters of reconciliation at the end. And I love this story of a dear friend of mine, as he's become, Chuck Toysh, who's a Vietnam veteran. He ran for Republican congressman from Milwaukee, I believe, some time ago. He now builds libraries throughout Vietnam. And the country has embraced him, and he has a lot of friends over there. And I said to him, I'm a little nervous about including these letters, you know, from, quote-unquote, the enemy, although there are only a few of those. A lot of them are from allies. And he said, you know what? This is how we get through this, and we need to talk, and we need to have these discussions. And we may disagree with some things on others, but this is the dialogue we need to have.
There's a letter that I want to listen to. This one was written by a 20-year-old American soldier, fellow by the name of Ron Livergood, Butch Livergood, writing to his parents in Gary, Indiana, from Ben Luc, Vietnam. Now, this is the winter of 1968, and in this letter, Butch Livergood is wondering if he should tell his wife about what's happened in Vietnam.
Dear Mom and Dad, hi, folks. Well, I'm sorry I haven't wrote to you in quite a while, but if you've been listening to news, you could pretty well figure it out. Saigon was hit heavy, and we were too. So they have been keeping us busy during day and night. We were mortared last night and about 4 days ago. Two of the fellows in the company were wounded, but nothing too serious. Now don't you start worrying about me. I am okay. A little nervous, but okay. Mom, I don't know if I should tell you this or not, but I have to tell somebody, and I can't tell Linda because she would worry too much, and I think you might be able to take it better than her. I think I might have killed a person, but I am not sure. We were fired at, and I seen some men running with rifles, so I opened fire on them, and one of them fell to the ground. I just pray to God for forgiveness. It shook me up quite a bit, but I am feeling better now, because we went out to where I seen him go down. We found blood, but no body. I'm glad of that. Well, I'm glad I got that off my chest, and I feel better now. I just hope you can forgive me. Mom, I don't know if I should tell you things that happen over here or not, because not too many of the guys write home about it. But the pressure builds up in me, and I just have to tell somebody. If Linda knew, she might not be able to live with me, knowing that her husband had killed a person. Well, I'll change the subject. How's all the kids back home? Fine, I hope. Tell everyone I send my love, and I'll be home in 327 days. I love you both, and I will write more later. Love, Butch. Your son in Vietnam. P.S. Write as often as possible. Mail call is all I have to look forward to. Love, Butch.
What a contrast, hey, to have how's all the kids back home in the same letter where this young guy is.
It's great for me to hear these letters because I've only been reading them, and that's the first time I've heard that letter read aloud. And I forgot how it encapsulates almost everything about what this book is about. On the one hand, you have, and this is true throughout all these letters, it's true throughout Iraq, it's true throughout the Civil War. On the one hand, not wanting to tell people on the home front the realities of warfare because you don't want to concern them. But on the other hand, that sense of catharsis, of having to tell somebody, because these are intensely emotional experiences. And then this issue of what it's like to kill somebody. We have a lot of letters like this. Now, admittedly, we have letters, say, by Russian soldiers talking about they can't wait to hunt down the German troops coming in and killing their families and so forth. And you can only understand the emotions they're going through. But so often we see in the movies this romanticized notion of just, you know, shooting someone and making a funny joke about it, which some troops do, to be honest. But for the most part, taking a life is a profoundly traumatic thing. And here he confides in that. Now, Vietnam letters are interesting because they were not censored. World War I, World War II, for the most part, were censored. Korea, Vietnam, the Civil War, et cetera, were not. Mm-hmm. So you see letters that tend to be a little bit more candid. But then, of course, the comment at the end about write to me and how important mail call is. I was just down at Fort Bragg, and I love visiting military bases. And we were doing a workshop for another project I'm doing with Operation Homecoming with the NEA. And one of the troops who was in Afghanistan said to me, I'll tell you, there was no sight to me more just heartwarming than we saw those trucks coming around the mountain, and we could almost catch the fluorescent orange color of the bags, and we knew that was mail. And I'll tell you, I would have given up food, sleep, anything just to get letters. And it's so letters have always been an intrinsic part of warfare, and there's some neat stories how letters have been used in wartime.
But what gets me about this one, the one that we just heard from Butch Livergood, is that unlike the letter from Paul Nash, who's kind of really searching for words that he thinks may outlive him, you can tell that. I mean, he's a beautiful writer, but in this one, it really is. It's thinking out loud. It's you're almost inside that young man's head.
This is the whole purpose of this project, is to give war that intimacy, that immediacy, that personality, because I think so often we get caught up in the statistics and the dates and the events and so forth, and this is when history can get a little overwhelming. What I want to show people is the human side of war, and that we should never take for granted what these young men and women go through. And that's, I have to admit, I admire what these men and women do so enormously, and I want people to better understand what they go through in all levels. That, you know, we have Dear John letters in the book to show that, you know, when these men and women are separated from their loved ones, one of the consequences is they lose their relationships. Two, we have these aftermath letters written by veterans years. We have one by Douglas MacArthur. These are all previously unpublished letters. MacArthur talking about the how he's haunted by the images of war after World War I.
And not just letters from soldiers, but letters from civilians and letters from foreign lands, giving a kind of a picture of war that we don't normally get. We're interested in hearing from you, Connection listeners, how this draws stories of war out in ways that we might not normally see them in history books and in the newspapers. We'd like to hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Support for The Connection.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Andrew Carroll is here with me in the studio. He's the author of a new book called Behind the Lines, Powerful and Revealing American and Foreign War Letters, One Man's Search to Find Them. That one man is Andrew Carroll. In fact, he was here 4 years ago talking about the book War Letters, and pretty well since that time he's been on the road, some 35 countries, 5 different continents, tens of thousands of letters that you've been searching through, and you're still looking for letters?
I can't emphasize that enough. Even though the book is out, I'm going on this 50-state tour. It's called the Mission Continues Tour, and the whole point is to keep telling people we're still looking for letters and emails from Iraq, from Afghanistan, or from other wars too. We want to preserve these letters and emails before they're lost. And one thing that breaks my heart is, it's really a testament to these men and women, they're so modest about what they do. But they'll throw away their letters or they'll delete their emails. And we want to remind them of how important their perspective is. And so that's a big part of the trip. And if they go to warletters.com.
Yeah, we have that link on our website.
Great, very easy to remember, warletters.com. There's information on how to preserve your letters. And we're not looking for originals. We ask for photocopies. We think the families should hold on to the originals or just forward us the emails. We don't publish them without permission,
right.
But we're keeping this archive so future generations will always understand what these men and women went through.
And just to clarify, is this like a commercial venture for you where you can spin out a dozen more books?
No, in fact, I'm giving all the royalties away from this book. All the earnings were given away from War Letters. And in fact, this is probably my last book like this. I plan to do many more books on the military and on history, but I don't want this to be seen as a factory of just churning out books.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. If you've got a story about the importance of a letter or that kind of connection, it doesn't have to be about the war in Iraq or Afghanistan, anyone, and going as far back in family history as you think that we'd be interested in hearing about, we'd like to hear from you. We're going to take a call from Lebanon, Tennessee, and Haywood's on the line. Hi, Haywood.
Good morning.
Thank you for calling.
I flew 3 tours in Vietnam, and people who haven't been in this situation don't understand. I'm a member of the Vietnam Helicopter Pilots Association, and this came up at our last meeting in Nashville, and our next meeting is July the 4th in San Francisco, and it will come up again because a lot of us officers made sure that our men wrote home. And in Vietnam, we had people who couldn't read and write and spell very well.
Haywood, when you said you made it your business to make sure that the men wrote home, did you think that that was a useful thing for morale in that country at that time?
Yes, it had to be.
I want you to try and explain that for people, if you can.
Well, you can't lose touch with your family. And, you know, some of these guys literally could not read or write. And they were sent over there to die.
Who wrote those letters for them?
I did a lot of times. Some of my NZOs did. But we made sure everybody could.
Hearing you talk about this, and it's just so moving to hear the emotions behind it. And one of the things that is so meaningful for me for this project is getting to talk with veterans. And I admire you all so much for what you do. And we have a lot of stories like this in the book. In fact, on sort of a somewhat lighter note, Alex Haley, the great author who wrote Roots, he was in the Coast Guard.
Yes.
And he wrote letters on behalf of his men. He wrote love letters back to the girlfriends and to the wives. And unfortunately, we're not able to find any of these letters, but you hear this a lot. And sometimes it's because the troops are wounded and they physically can't write the letters. But as you said, sometimes it's because they're not able. But mail on both sides, the receiving and for the recipients and for those who are sending them over, it's just there's almost nothing more important for morale. And
I've seen people stand in a monsoon for 3 hours waiting on the helicopter with the mail.
Do you still have your old letters?
Oh, yeah. I found some that my mom had hid.
Well,
grandparents.
We would love to see copies of them if you'd be willing to share them with us. And and if you have access to the web, it's thewarletters.com and all the information. And these letters go directly to me. I will read them, and I promise I'll respond to you as well.
Okay.
But thank you so
much. It's in San Francisco.
The whole schedule of where I'm going around the trip is on the website, too. And I'm coming to Nashville, and I'm coming to San Francisco, so hopefully we'll be able to connect at some point.
I'm coming to Nashville. I own a truck stop called Uncle Pete's.
I'm going to look for you.
I'll buy you the best cup of coffee you've ever had in your life.
All right, we're going to make it happen.
All right.
Hey, I'm taking a note of this truck stop.
Hey, Uncle Pete's. All right, I'm going to remember that. Haywood. Okay.
Just remember the theory, a great place to eat where everybody's treated like a niece or nephew.
Okay. Haywood, I want
to... Our memorial wall to Vietnam vets.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much.
You have a great day.
You too.
Hey, Wood, I want to let you listen in on another letter, which jumps to another generation and another time, but I think in many ways illustrates what it is Andrew's talking about when you gather all these together. This takes us back to the end of the First World War, and there's a mother in Val-de-Bain, France, who finds herself writing to the mother of a young soldier with the American Expeditionary Force, and what she has to do in this letter is explain to the soldier's mother that her son has died.
Val-de-Bain, France. Dear Madame, it is a mother who is writing to you, a mother who has been with your dear child in his last days, and it had seemed to me that to tell you a little of his last acts and gestures may soften the bitterness of your grief. Your son came with the 310th Band to pass a few days at Val-les-Bains in the Paris Hotel, of which my husband and I are the proprietors. The first week I noticed him but little. As they all wore the same uniform, I scarcely distinguished them one from the other. At the end of the week, as a result of an epidemic of the grippe, there were many sick in the house who stood about the fireplace, for it was very cold at the time. Then I noticed the little blonde, as we called him, not knowing his name. I made hot drinks for him and his comrades, but after 2 days he preferred to stay in bed. The doctor at his first visit did not consider his condition serious. But at a second visit, in reply to my question, he answered, "It is serious, very serious. It appears that your dear child had a fall 2 months before on getting upon a train or truck, and very serious disorder in the vertical column resulted. After this second visit, his condition grew worse, though he was without great suffering. The poor little fellow was drowsy, and we had to shake him and talk to him to get him to take liquid. His comrades were admirably devoted and cared for him as no nurse would have done. He was for them a little brother, whom they petted and spoiled to quiet his pain. He was never left alone, day or night, and when they saw him depart, they wept like children. How I have regretted that I did not speak English. The doctor, having decided an operation was necessary, they decided to take him to Montélimar. His comrades put him into the conveyance, but the poor boy no longer knew what was going on about him, so was spared the anguish of saying goodbye. An hour before he left, my husband and I went up to see him, and I kissed his forehead in his mother's name, then cut off this lock of hair as a last remembrance, but he noticed nothing. Well, one thing certain is that though your son was deprived of his mother's care, he did not know the commonplaceness of a hospital bed, and so long as he was conscious, saw about him the faces of devoted friends. The chaplain came to see him before he left. The American authorities had his body brought back to the cemetery of Val-les-Bains, where he rests beside several of his comrades. When I go to see the graves of my own family, I assure you, madame, that he will have a visit for his mother's sake. If I can be of any service to you, I am entirely at your service. With all my sympathies, I am yours. Madame Armand, Hotel de Paris, Val-les-Bains, Ardèche.
People ask me from the trip, because I focus so much on war and there's so many combat letters and the civilian letters are very... There's some very disturbing material in the book, if it's affected my perception of human nature coming out of this. And one of the strange things, it even surprised me, was that people were so generous, so hospitable, so sharing on the trip. And along with the letters I came across that showed sort of the darker side of human nature, there's so many letters like this one that show the humanity. Here you have a complete stranger writing to a mother who she knows is in tremendous grief over the loss of her son, just to assure her that her boy was taken care of, knew sweetness and kindness in his final moments, and that someone would continue to remember him in this faraway land. And just going back to Heywood, who just, it was such a, just so moving to hear him talk about this. One of the most poignant things I discovered traveling the world and here in the U.S. is the desire of older veterans to share these stories, to talk about this, so that the young kids coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan now would know that they're not alone. And that sense of camaraderie, which reaches across services and generations and so forth, really struck me. And it's been a very, it's been a profoundly moving experience working on this book and going on the trip. But you do see a lot of the best of human nature, and we've just seen two examples of that.
That one little letter we just heard reminds me of Walt Whitman traveling to the hospitals
in
and
the
doing
Civil War.
The same in the Civil War,
absolutely,
and gathering up the letters and saying, "I was with your son when he died." That was something that
and it
that
means
mattered
so
to
much
him.
To the people there, and of course, so much to the families.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join our conversation this hour. Andrew Carroll is here with me. We're talking about his new book, Behind the Lines. We're going to Raleigh, North Carolina for a call from Wendell. Hi, Wendell. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate you taking my call. This is going to be a confession of sorts. I was the house mouse for a detachment with the 1839th out of Mississippi.
What's a house mouse, Wendell?
A house mouse, that is the, he's kind of like the administrative guy. He handles all the correspondence between the units that are detached.
Right.
And, you know, I would go, when the mail would come in, I would sort the mail at the mail room, and then I would take the mail that went back to my detachment with me. During the time that my wife was pregnant with my oldest child, I was sent away. I was supposed to be gone during the time that she was going to have the baby. And because I was married is why I was selected, because I got mail every day. It was, it, you know, mail call is sacred. There's, you know, when you come back with the mail, everybody in the unit, no matter what they're doing, no matter how important their job is at the time, stops. Everything stops for mail call. And I had received orders to go back to Germany, and so I called ahead, and I had my mail stopped so I could pick it up when I got back to Zweibrücken. But a change in the mission had come up, and they kept me, and everybody in the unit, they were really full of glee because nobody wanted to go down and sort the mail, because you were sorting the mail and you didn't get any mail, it was an emotional experience. And I always got mail and nobody wanted to do it.
Was it even more emotional to sort the mail and not get one than to stand there and listen to the other names being read out?
Yes, definitely, absolutely. Because there'd be troops that were assigned to me. The house mouse is a job that is usually delegated to the lowest ranking person. But because of the type of mission we were on, myself being of a higher rank was assigned to pick the mail up. And anyway, when I stopped my mail, and you know, I didn't get any mail for like 3 weeks. Man, it was almost more than a person can bear to you know. I knew no mail was coming, and I didn't want to support the mail. So what happened was, when my orders got extended and I was staying, I called back and I said overnight the next mail drop, and they sent my mail, but it for some reason it was taking longer than it was supposed to. And they would fly the mail into Sigonella, and then they would send it down to Camisa, which is where we were. And when the mail finally did come, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
When the mail finally did come, I had a stack of letters, and I did such a disservice to my troops because I took the letters and I organized them, and I put all of my letters in the rear. And when I called for mail call, everybody stopped what they were doing and come, and there were about half the people that did not receive any mail. And when I got down, I still had this, you know, I'd called everybody's mail and I was down to mine. And what you do is you call the name and you throw it out into the crowd. And the letter finds its way to whoever the person is, because when you call the name and you throw the letter, the person whose name you called knows that's their letter. Nothing else is important. They know exactly where that letter is.
So how many letters were you holding when you were just down to your own mail? How many were left in your hand?
About 20. And I sat there and I called my name and I called my name and I called my name again and again and again. And the pain that I caused my troops is a burden that I still bear today, because they were forced to sit there and listen to the fact that I had 20 letters. They didn't have any. And you know, with my wife being pregnant, every one of my letters had a picture. And there's an art to writing a letter home that many soldiers, many airmen, master. They start off with a salutation. Basically, how good it is for me to sit down here and write this letter, and, you know, you go through a paragraph.
Window, we're starting to lose your line a little bit here. I wanted to step in on the point that you were describing on mail call and bring Andrew back in, because what's so telling, and Wendell, I thank you for sharing that story with us, what's so telling about it is that the mail call is a very personal thing. I need to know that I'm in touch with family, but it's also kind of a public thing, because it, in the company, is an expression of how you are loved or regarded by people who aren't there.
I can't stress enough to anyone who knows someone who serves overseas, if it's an old high school friend, if it's a distant cousin, write to them as much as possible. They will not encourage you to do it because, again, they're very modest. I want to just say one thing to Wendell to sort of set him at ease. First of all, I think his men would understand that with his pregnant wife and all that's going on, that he deserved a little bit of attention himself because of all the anxiety he was probably going through. And if it makes any difference, I'll tell you a story of a true confession. A group of censors, a gentleman sent a letter home to his mom during World War II. And he saw it when he returned home, and he said, wait a minute. At the bottom, it said, hey, Mom, how about that fruitcake you promised me? And he looked at the letter, and he said, Mom, I never wrote that. It turned out what the censors were doing was they would add lines like that to the letters, like send food, send gifts, whatever. And then when the food came back, they would intercept it, and they kept it. So now there's a real confession. But yeah.
Yes, indeed. Stories from Behind the Lines. Andrew Carroll is here with me. We do want to hear from you, and our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Certainly, just the last few stories are evidence enough of how much mail matters. Your thought on what it tells us about war, because in part that's what the collection of letters from overseas, as well as from here in this country, can lead us to. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Andrew Carroll is here with me. He is the author of a new book called Behind the Lines, a collection of how many letters in this one book alone?
200 rare and previously unpublished letters.
And these are letters that cover, what, almost five centuries?
American Revolution all the way up to Iraq.
Okay, 300 years. Okay.
Right. And one thing I tried to do just quickly was with the revolution letters I picked, where they show guerrilla warfare. They show the sense of violence and the sense of the treatment of prisoners of war during that time. So I tried to make it relevant to things we talk about today so that you're not just reading, oh, here's a Civil War letter, but, mm-hmm. oh, this is a Civil War letter about a terrorist attack on New York. And just how these parallels and these echoes happen.
All right. We're asking our listeners to join us with their stories. Let's go to Betsy, who's on the line in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hi, Betsy. Thanks for calling.
Hi. So, hi, I'm here.
Yeah, we hear you. What's your story, Betsy?
Well, my story is a very coveted piece of literature in my family, and that is a telegram that my father, who is now 79 but was 19 at the time, sent after he was liberated from prisoner of war camp in Germany in May 1945. And he had been missing, presumed, for...
Betsy, we're losing your line there. Are you walking away from the phone or something?
No, I'm here.
Okay. I need you to be quick for me because the telephone's not too clear.
Okay. He was missing, presumed dead, and my grandfather assumed he was dead. And when he was liberated... 7 months later, he sent a telegram saying, "Am alive, Marseille, Alan."
So for 7 months, the family thought he was dead, and then the telegram came.
And that was the first correspondence.
And that's why these are just so important to preserve. And I'm sure that in this family, they know how valuable it is.
That one particularly.
One in particular. And we have, I'm partial to prisoner of war correspondences because you think of what these men have gone through. And some women, too, have been captured, nurses at Bataan and Corregidor. And I do want to segue into one quick thing because it relates. One of the most extraordinary letters we came across is by a young American soldier who was also a POW. And he also wrote home to his family. And it's a longer letter, but he just happened to be Kurt Vonnegut Jr. And people forget that he was captured. He was actually at Battle of the Bulge. And he survived Dresden. He was there when the firebombing happened, which is, of course, what Slaughterhouse-Five became the great novel that he wrote about that experience. And he forgot that he wrote this letter. It was sitting in a little archive in Indianapolis. And thanks to a friend of a friend, I came across it. And it's in the book. And it is a tremendous letter. And it's about his experience as a POW and being captured and everything.
And as I'm listening to Betsy talk about the importance of this telegram, and of course nobody in this country needs to be reminded about how frightening the arrival of a telegram could be at wartime, you jump ahead to where we are today with wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and one of the things that Andrew's looking at and using in the book is not just letters, but emails. I want to hear just a short exchange between two mothers, Gloria Callis and Terry Ward, exchanging emails about the loss of their two boys in the war in Afghanistan.
Dear Gloria, thank you so much for the condolences on the Fallen Heroes site for my son. May I also express my condolences on the loss of your own son. I am so devastated, and I cannot figure out how to go on. How do you manage every day? My son had three young sons, 11, 10, and 7. How do I help them? And his wife, who loved him so much. I know I need to be strong for them also, but I am so sad myself. So sorry to ask you these questions.
Deeply affected by his loss.
But you have been there also. So
normal will never be what it was before. We've all had to redefine normal. Nothing will ever be the same. But you learn to take one day at a time. Sometimes there are bad days. Sometimes worse days. But I know that as long as I have a breath in my body, my son will live in my heart. I'm sure you feel the same. My faith sustains me, and I know that I will be reunited with him when I, too, go home. I know I'm rambling, Terry. My heart aches for you. Please get back to me. Tell me more about Tony. I'm sure you are extremely proud of him, as I am of Ernie. By his grace, Gloria.
Andrew, one of the things that I find particularly striking is that of all the letters, when you begin to add them up and get a sense of the whole rather than the individual ones, is that it's soldiers and the victims, the civilians, mothers, fathers, widows, all those people who end up expressing, in fact, the greatest capacity for forgiveness under the circumstances that they're in.
One of the things I think these letters show, because in some ways they transcend war, they're about human nature and all the different things we see in these traumatic times, life and death circumstances, but the sense of resilience. And when people ask me, what do you hope audiences will get out of these letters? Well, of course, to see the sacrifices made by those who serve and the families. And I'm so glad you all picked those two letters because we often overlook the home front. Mm-hmm. And we are looking for letters by the wives and the moms, although now we're sending women off to war in frontline capacities. So it's the husbands on the home front who are writing the home front letters.
Be careful about your
writing. Absolutely. Right. And they're serving and they are dying over there too. And I actually draw a lot of inspiration from these letters because, as I said, you see the best of human nature. And that exchange, just to give a little background, those were total strangers. Those were two women who had both – one lost her son in Afghanistan, one in Iraq. And when Terry wrote to Gloria, it was looking for help and saying, I know you don't know me, but only you can understand what I'm going through. And Gloria wrote this incredibly compassionate and beautiful letter in response. And here these two women leaning on each other, again, who are total strangers. And that is just – there's something so powerful about that, so meaningful.
Let's go back to our phone lines to Newton, Massachusetts. Rob's joining us from there. Hello, Rob.
Yes, hi. Hi, my father was a Marine in World War II, and he saw a lot of combat in the South Pacific. And fortunately, his mother saved all the letters that he wrote home. And since he's passed away, I've been in possession of those letters, and I'm in the process of transcribing them all because his handwriting was pretty sloppy, but transcribing them and putting them together with some photos to give to my mother as an 80th birthday present. But
are you learning anything from reading through them, Rob?
Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the themes that I've seen throughout the letters is despite, you know, he'll talk about being depressed at what's going on and hearing about some of his friends and classmates dying, he always weaves in a message of, don't worry about me, I'm okay, you know, I'm safe. You know, I don't want you to worry, I'll be home and all that. So, you know, I think he really, through his letters, tried to comfort the folks at home that he was going to be okay. Because he also had a brother who was in the Navy in combat in World War II as well. So
I mean, the funny thing is that just by the act of writing the letter, we know he's okay. And yet people want to put that down on paper.
Absolutely. It's that same desire we talked about with earlier and with the Livergood letter. And I'm just so glad to hear that you're transcribing these because it really makes it easier for the families to hold on to these. And I encourage people, look in your attics, your basements, your closets. You'll be amazed by what you find. You know, the most heartbreaking letters I received were not the war letters. They were the cover letters that came with them. A woman wrote to me and said, these are the letters my brother wrote from Vietnam. He came home and he disappeared. He was so traumatized by the war that one day he was just gone. And I want someone to remember him. And so please accept these letters. Another woman wrote to me just very quickly, I never really knew my father. He was very distant. He was very reserved when I was growing up. And then I came across his love letters to my mom when he was a teenager. He was a soldier off in Europe. And I found this passionate, whimsical young kid. And I was like, where was he? And she wondered, did the war do it to him? Or did he hide the best part of himself? But she said, for the first time, I connected with him through his letters.
1-800-423-8255. We're off to next to Worcester, Mass. And John's with us. Hi, John.
Hey, I'm a World War II vet. And I have a boy who came home safely from Vietnam and was in the Marines. In 68, he wrote a long letter, was published, and this is a couple of things. The death I have seen here today is not of the dignified, seemingly triumphant variety. It is the purposeful, matter-of-fact death, for me, that has no purpose, that cannot be taken matter-of-factly. It becomes distinctly personal. I got one more little half a paragraph. Can you stay with me?
You go ahead.
We found on patrol this morning a young Vietnamese boy with his throat cut ear to ear, the VC, the Viet Cong, had killed him in the night. To those who have been here long enough to have seen him around, he was a friend. But I can't help thinking that he was a Viet Cong. Cruel of me to say it, I suppose. Well, that's part of his letter, but a lot of the letter has really, really depth and feeling.
John, do you remember receiving that letter?
I sure do.
And does it feel different today when you read it?
changed my mind. Well, being a World War II vet, it was, you know, my country, right or wrong. And then my son was over there. I was just anxious to get him home. That's all I cared about. And when I heard this, I just felt sort of like helpless. And he included in this letter many things political and all the rest, but that particular phrase was very poignant to me.
One of the things that Andrew marks in going through the letters is how the young men and women who go overseas to serve recognize while they're there that they're growing up while they're there and they're going to come back different people.
One of the things I wanted to show were the echoes of war. We've talked some about the historical echoes of things that have been very similar. And what really surprised me were the emotional echoes. We have a letter from 1953 by a young private coming out of Korea. And he says to his parents, he's writing home, that, you know, he's on his way back. I'm not the boy who you saw leave. I'm a man now who's seen things will be haunted by for the rest of my life, and I'm in no rush actually for you to see me because I've changed so much. 50 years later, we have this letter from Iraq, and it was a handwritten letter. The mom gave it to me, and I've since met the son. Mother's Day is coming, so I wish I were there to see you. I've missed so much since I left for the Army. That's what makes coming home scarier than here. At least here we know what to do. Shoot back. Home, I won't know what to do, how to act. That's what worries me. Here we use violence to fix problems. I can't do that at home, so I have to relearn how to live a normal life. I miss you so much and can't wait to see you. A lot of them grapple with this, and again, the willingness to share the letters was, I think, partially, maybe even subconsciously, a desire to say, we've been there too. We know what you're going through, and it's their way of reaching out.
You know, the really interesting thing when we listen to that sequence of letters, John telling the story of his son writing from Vietnam, and this letter from Iraq, that there is within all the writing of each war a notion that maybe this won't happen again, that maybe if we understand what's going on in the Second World War, we'll never do this again. And Vietnam is the same thing, and here we are again.
And we have letters that say explicitly that, especially World War II is particularly powerful, the letters written at the end of that war, like the Vonnegut letter, mm-hmm. the VE letters, the VJ letters. The frontline combat troops are not jumping up and down. It's not the celebratory sense because they're so emotionally cauterized by what they've seen. And it's like anyone who goes through a trauma, if it's the death of a close person, you get through the funeral, you get through that. It's afterwards that the emotions really hit you. And that's one of the things you notice in these letters, that these guys have seen so much that they're just devastated and they want to make sure that no other generation has to go through it again.
I want to hear one more letter from your collection, and this is one that I didn't actually expect to find in the book. I'm not going to say anything more about it except that it's a very recent letter from a teenage girl in Iraq writing to her aunt in the United States.
I need from you to help us move from here because we are dying here and bomb blasts are taking place every day in our neighborhood. The other day, there was a bomb blast in front of my school and I almost got killed. I need from you to save us, and I beg you, if you really love us and care for us as relatives, then you would save us from here. Please call us. It has been days or months that we haven't talked on the phone. Please, don't come back here, because bombings are all over. Save us. Save us. And don't even think about coming back here. And stay where you are. For the sake of our being a family, save us. Love you, and anticipating to hearing from you soon. Soronaz.
So there's a letter that we wouldn't normally put in the pile of war letters. And you spent time, as you said at the beginning of the program, in both Iraq and in Afghanistan, talking to soldiers and people there. Part of the point, I think, is that these letters matter as much today as we know they did in the Second World War and in Korea and in places that are more a part of our literature and lore.
And this is the humanity of warfare. This is what everyone stressed to me was they wanted others to understand the totality of warfare, how it impacts people. The war doesn't stop, like what we saw, the two moms writing to each other. That happened when both wars were soon to be over. But the wars don't often stop when the peace treaties are signed or the last bullets are fired. There are emotional impacts. There's all sorts of aftermath types of all these issues that keep going. And the generosity of these people to share these, because there's some their emotions behind this, the painfulness, the wounds of war, to bring up these stories again was very difficult. But they stressed over and over and over again, whether they were troops or civilians or veterans or whomever, we want people to understand this. And it's not about Iraq. It's not about Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. It's about war. And I think there's a feeling in the country, too, that we're not talking about it as much as we should.
We're going to take one more call, and it's Jeff joining us on the line from Alma. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. You know, back in Gulf War One, I was a personnel NCO, and I had about 15 soldiers in my section. And we were sitting up on the border getting ready to cross, wondering when we were going to cross into Iraq, Christmas Day, 1990. And mail call came, and I was the only one that got mail that day. And it was a care package for my wife with my Christmas and a little doily Christmas tree and all that. Mm-hmm. I put my guys off the berm that I could and let them all go into the tent and gave them a Christmas present because they didn't get anything. The only one who got anything was me. And, you know, that's made me, I mean, I still have conservative values and everything, but, you know, that made me a more loving and giving person than I was before this kind of thing ever happened. And it's important for the soldiers and the sailors and the Marines and the Air Forcemen to get these types of gifts, because someday somebody gets something, someday somebody doesn't. And the day that somebody doesn't and he's feeling bad, your son, your daughter, your husband, your wife, whoever's over there that you know can at least give a little bit of something to make somebody's day a little bit better over there.
One final quick comment along those lines. One of the patterns we see in war is after about 2 or 3 years, the troops on the front lines feel forgotten. It's so important. And we saw this in the Afghanistan letters when the Iraq War broke up, and we're just now seeing it with the Iraq War. We cannot send 140,000, 150,000 men and women over there and forget them. If we're going to do it, if society's going to send them over, we got to remember them every day. And one of the best ways we can do it is writing to them and sending them care packages.
All right, Jeff, I thank you for that call and sharing that memory. And Andrew, I thank you for coming in to tell us about this collection. A reminder to our listeners that if you go to our website, we're at theconnection.org. You can find the links that will allow you to find out a lot more about the exchange of letters and the ongoing project that Andrew is involved in. Chance for me to thank the people here at WBUR who did the readings of the letters for today's program: Anna Benstead, Meghna Chakrabarty, Dolores Handy, James Ross, Wendy Schwartz, and our own Doug Sugarts. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Support